frantically paying borrowed money to the old man who was then the oracle, making sacrifices of valuable animals. No man ever cared more for her than he did. And it seemed that the medicine worked. Her body ceased its thrashing and struggling, and her senses returned. But she found herself vastly changed. She had a control over her body that was clearly beyond anything other people could manage. She could look inside herself and control or alter what she saw there. She could finally be worthy of her husband and of her own womanhood. She could become pregnant. She bore her husband 10 strong children. In the centuries that followed, she never did more for any man. When she realized the years had ceased to mark her body, she experimented and learned to age herself as her husband aged. She learned quickly that it was not good to be too different. Great differences caused envy, suspicion, fear, charges of witchcraft. But while her first husband lived, she never entirely gave up her beauty. And sometimes, when he came to her at night, she allowed her body to return to the youthful shape that came so easily, so naturally, the true shape. In that way, her husband had a young, senior wife for as long as he lived. And now, Okoye had a mother's mother who appeared to be younger than he was.
Inyochi? The boy said doubtfully. Mother's mother?
Still, Anyanwu said. This is the way I look when I do nothing, and this is the way I look when I marry a new husband.
But you are old.
The years do not touch me.
Nor him? Your new husband?
Nor him.
Okoye shook his head.
I should not be here. I am only a man. What will you do with me?
You belong to Doro. He will say what is to be done with you. But you need not worry. He wants me as his wife. He will not harm you.
The water harmed him. Soon after Anyanwu had revealed herself, he began to grow ill. He became dizzy. His head hurt him. He said he thought he would vomit if he did not leave the confinement of the small room. Anyanwu took him out on deck where the air was fresh and cooler. But even there, the gentle rocking of the ship seemed to bother him, and began to bother her. She began to feel ill. She seized on the feeling at once, examining it. There was drowsiness, dizziness, and a sudden cold sweat. She closed her eyes, and while Okoye vomited into the water, she went over her body carefully. She discovered there was a wrongness, a kind of imbalance deep within her ears. It was a tiny disturbance, but she knew her body well enough to notice the smallest change. For a moment, she observed this change with interest. Clearly, if she did nothing to correct it, her sickness would grow worse. She would join Okoye, vomiting over the rail. But no, she focused on her inner ears and remembered perfection there, remembered organs and fluids and pressures in balance, their wrongness righted. Remembering and correcting were one gesture. Balance was restored. It had taken her much practice and much pain to learn such ease of control. Every change she made in her body had to be understood and visualized. If she was sick or injured, she could not simply wish to be well. She could be killed as easily as anyone else if her body was damaged in some way she could not understand quickly enough to repair. Thus, she had spent much of her long life learning the diseases, disorders, and injuries that she could suffer, learning them often by inflicting mild versions of them on herself, then slowly, painfully, by trial and error, coming to understand exactly what was wrong and how to impress healing. Thus, when her enemies came to kill her, she knew more about surviving than they did about killing. And now she knew how to set right this new disturbance that could have caused her considerable misery. But her knowledge was of no help to Okoye, yet she searched through her memory for some substance that would help him.
Within her long memory was a catalog of cures and poisons, often the same substances given in different quantities, with different preparation, or in different combinations. Many of them she could manufacture within her body, as she had manufactured a healing balm for Doro's hand. This time, though, before she thought of anything that might be useful, a white man came to her, bringing a small metal container full of some liquid. The man looked at Okoye, then nodded, and put the container into Anyanwu's hands. He made signs to indicate that she should get Okoye to drink. Anyanwu looked at the container, then sipped from it herself. She would not give anyone medicine she did not understand. The liquid was startlingly strong stuff that first choked her, then slowly, pleasantly, warmed her, pleased her. It was like palm wine, but much stronger. A little of it might make Okoye forget his misery. A little more might make him sleep. It was no cure, but it would not hurt him, and it might help. Anyanwu thanked the white man in her own language, and saw that he was looking at her breasts. He was a beardless, yellow-haired young man, a physical type completely strange to Anyanwu. Another time, her curiosity would have driven her to learn more about him, try to communicate with him. She found herself wondering obscurely whether the hair between his legs was as yellow as that on his head. She laughed aloud at herself, and the young man, unknowing, watched her breasts jiggle. Enough of that. She took Okoye back into the cabin, and when the yellow-haired man followed, she stepped in front of him and gestured unmistakably for him to leave. He hesitated, and she decided that if he touched her uninvited, she would throw him into the sea. Sea, yes, that was the English word for water. If she said it, would he understand? But the man left without coercion. Anyanwu coaxed Okoye to swallow some of the liquid. It made him cough and choke at first, but he got it down. By the time Doro came to the cabin, Okoye was asleep. Doro opened the door without warning and came in. He looked at her with obvious pleasure and said,
"You are well, Anyanwu. I thought you would be." "I am always well."
He laughed.
"You will bring me luck on this voyage. Come and see whether my men have bought any more of your relatives."
She followed him deeper into the vessel through large rooms containing only a few people segregated by sex. The people lounged on mats or gathered in pairs or small groups to talk, those who had found others who spoke their language. No one was chained as the slaves on shore had been. No one seemed to be hurt or frightened. Two women sat nursing their babies. Anyanwu heard many languages, including, finally, her own. She stopped at the mat of a young woman who had been singing softly to her.
"Who are you?"
she asked the woman in surprise. The woman jumped to her feet, took Anyanwu's hands.
"You can't speak,"
she said joyfully.
"I thought I would never again hear words I could understand. I am Odenkwo."
The woman's own speech was somewhat strange to Anyanwu. She pronounced some of her words differently or used different words so that Anyanwu had to replay everything in her mind to be certain what had been said.
"How did you get here, Odenkwo?"
she asked.
"Did these whites steal you from your home?"
From the corner of her eye, she saw Doro turn to look at her indignantly. But he allowed Odenkwo to answer for herself.
"Not these," she said. "Strangers who spoke much as you do. They sold me to others. I was sold 4 times, finally to these."
She looked around as though dazed, surprised.
"No one has beaten me here or tied me." "How were you taken?" "I went to the river with friends to get water. We were all taken, and our children with us. My son."
"Where is he?"
"They took him from me. When I was sold for the 2nd time, he was not sold with me."
The woman's strange accent did nothing to mask her pain. She looked from Anyanwu to Doro.
"What will be done with me now?"
This time Doro answered.
"You will go to my country.
You belong to me now.
I am a freeborn woman. My father and my husband are great men.
That is past.
Let me go back to my people.
My people will be your people. You will obey me as they obey. Udenkwo sat still, but somehow seemed to shrink from him.
Will I be tied again? Will I be beaten?
Not if you obey.
Will I be sold?
No. She hesitated, examining him as though deciding whether or not to believe him. Finally, tentatively, she asked,
Will you buy my son?
I would, Doro said. But who knows where he may have been taken? One boy. How old was he?
About 5 years old.
Doro shrugged. I would not know how to find him. Anyanwu had been looking at Udenkwo uncertainly. Now, as the woman seemed to sink into depression at the news that her son was forever lost to her, Anyanwu asked,
Udenkwo, who is your father and his father?
The woman did not answer.
Your father,
Anyanwu repeated.
His people.
Listlessly, Udenkwo gave the name of her clan, then went on to name several of her male ancestors. Anyanwu listened until the names and their order began to sound familiar, until one of them was the name of her eighth son, then her third husband. Anyanwu stopped the recitation with a gesture.
I have known some of your people, she said. You are safe here. You will be well treated.
She began to move away.
I will see you again.
She drew Doro with her, and when they were beyond the woman's hearing, she asked,
Could you not look for her son?
No, Doro said. I told her the truth. I would not know where to begin, or even whether the boy is still alive.
She is one of my descendants.
As you said, she will be well treated. I can offer no more than that. Doro glanced at her. The land must be full of your descendants. And Yanwu looked somber.
You are right. They are so numerous, so well scattered, and so far from me in their generations that they do not know me or each other. Sometimes they marry one another and I hear of it. It is abomination, but I cannot speak of it without focusing the wrong kind of attention on the young ones. They cannot defend themselves as I can.
You are right to keep silent, Doro said. Sometimes ways must be different for people as different as ourselves.
We?
She said thoughtfully.
Did you have children of a body born to your mother?
He shook his head.
I died too young, he said. I was 13 years old. That is a sad thing, even for you.
Yes. They were on deck now, and he stared out at the sea.
I have lived for more than 3,700 years and fathered thousands of children. I have become a woman and born children. And still, I long to know what my body could have produced. Another being like myself? A companion?
Perhaps not, said Anyanwu. You might have been like me, having one ordinary child after another.
Doro shrugged and changed the subject.
You must take your daughter's son to meet that girl when he is feeling better. That girl's age is wrong, but she is still a little younger than Okoye. Perhaps they will comfort each other.
They are kinsmen.
They will not know that unless you tell them, and you should be silent once more. They have only each other, Anyanwu. If they wish, they can marry after the customs of their new land.
And how is that?
There is a ceremony. They pledge themselves to each other before a...
He said an English word, then translated.
A priest.
They have no family but me, and the girl does not know me.
It does not matter.
It will be a poor marriage.
No. I will give them land and seed. Others will teach them to live in their new country. It is a good place. People need not stay poor there if they will work.
Children of mine will work.
Then all will be well. He left her, and she wandered around the deck looking at the ship and the sea and the dark line of trees on shore. The shore seemed very far away. She watched it with the beginnings of fear, of longing. Everything she knew was back there deep within those trees, through strange forests. She was leaving all her people in a way that seemed far more permanent than simply walking away. She turned away from the shore, frightened of the sudden emotion that threatened to overwhelm her. She looked at the men, some black, some white. As they moved about the deck doing work, she did not understand. The yellow-haired white man came to smile at her and stare at her breasts until she wondered whether he had ever seen a woman before. He spoke to her slowly, very distinctly.
"Isaac," he said, pointing to his chest. "Isaac."
Then he jabbed a finger toward her, but he did not touch her. He raised his bushy, pale eyebrows questioningly.
"Isaac?"
she said, stumbling over the word.
"Isaac."
He slapped his chest. Then he pointed again.
"You?"
"Anyanwu,"
she said, understanding.
"Anyanwu."
She smiled. And he smiled and mispronounced her name and walked her around the deck, naming things for her in English. The new language, so different from anything she had ever heard, had fascinated her since Doro began teaching it to her. Now she repeated the words very carefully and strove to remember them. The yellow-haired Isaac seemed delighted. When finally someone called him away, he left her reluctantly. The loneliness returned as soon as he was gone. There were people all around her, but she felt completely alone on this huge vessel at the edge of endless water. Loneliness. Why should she feel it so strongly now? She had been lonely since she realized she would not die like other people. They would always leave her. Friends, husbands, children. She could not remember the face of her mother or her father. But now, the solitude seemed to close in on her, as the waters of the sea would close over her head if she leaped into them. She stared down into the constantly moving water, then away at the distant shore. The shore seemed even farther away now, though Doro had said the ship was not yet underway. Anyanwu felt that she had moved farther away from her home, that already perhaps she was too far away, ever to return. She gripped the rail, eyes on the shore. What was she doing, she wondered. How could she leave her homeland, even for Doro? How could she live among these strangers? White skins, yellow hairs? What were they to her? Worse than strangers. Different ones. People who could be all around her working and shouting, and still leave her feeling alone. She pulled herself up onto the rail.
"Anyanwu!"
She did not quite hesitate. It was as though a mosquito had whined past her ear, a tiny distraction.
"Anyanwu!"
She would leap into the sea. Its waters would take her home, or they would swallow her. Either way, she would find peace. Her loneliness hurt her like some sickness of the body, some pain that her special ability could not find and heal. The sea... Hands grasped her, pulled her backward and down onto the deck. Hands kept her from the sea.
"Anyanwu!"
The yellow hair loomed above her, the white skin. What right had he to lay hands on her?
"Stop, Anyanwu!"
he shouted. She understood the English word, stop, but she ignored it. She brushed him aside and went back to the rail.
"Anyanwu!"
A new voice, new hands.
"Anyanwu, you are not alone here."
Perhaps no other words could have stopped her. Perhaps no other voice could have driven away her need to end the terrible solitude so quickly. Perhaps only her own language could have overwhelmed the call of the distant shore.
Doro?
She found herself in his arms, held fast. She realized that she had been on the verge of breaking those arms, if necessary, to get free, and she was appalled.
Doro, something happened to me.
I know. Her fury was spent. She looked around dazedly. The yellow hair, what had happened to him?
Isaac?
She said fearfully. Had she thrown the young man into the sea? There was a burst of foreign speech behind her, frightened and defensive in tone. Isaac. She turned and saw him alive and dry, and was too relieved to wonder at his tone. He and Doro exchanged words in their English, then Doro spoke to her. He did not hurt you, Anyanwu?
No.
She looked at the young man who was holding a red place on his right arm.
I think I have hurt him.
She turned away in shame, appealed to Doro.
He helped me. I would not have hurt him, but some spirit possessed me.
Shall I apologize for you?
Doro seemed amused.
Yes.
She went over to Isaac, said his name softly, touched the injured arm. Not for the first time, she wished she could mute the pain of others as easily as she could mute her own. She heard Doro speak for her, saw the anger leave the young man's face. He smiled at her, showing bad teeth, but good humor. Apparently he forgave her.
He says you are as strong as a man,
Doro told her. She smiled.
I can be as strong as many men, but he need not know that.
He can know, Doro said. He has strength of his own. He is my son.
You're
the son of an American, buddy.
Doro smiled as though he had made a joke.
A mixed buddy, white and black and Indian. Indians are a brown people.
But he is white.
His mother was white. German and yellow-haired. He is more her son than mine, in appearance at least.
Anyanwu shook her head, looking longingly at the distant coast.
There is nothing for you to fear, Doro said softly. You are not alone. Your children's children are here. I am here.
How can you know what I feel?
I would have to be blind not to know, not to see.
But
do you think you are the first woman I have taken from her people? I have been watching you since we left your village, knowing that this time would come for you. Our kind have a special need to be with either our kinsmen or others who are like us.
You are not like me.
He said nothing. He had answered this once, she remembered. Apparently, he did not intend to answer it again. She looked at him, at the tall, young body, well-made and handsome.
Will I see someday what you are like when you are not hiding in another man's skin?
For an instant, it seemed that a leopard looked at her through his eyes. A thing looked at her, and that thing, feral and cold. A spirit thing that spoke softly.
Pray to your gods that you never do, Anyanwu. Let me be a man. Be content with me as a man.
He put his hand out to touch her, and it amazed her that she did not flinch away, that she trembled, but stood where she was. He drew her to him, and to her surprise, she found comfort in his arms. The longing for home, for her people, which had threatened to possess her, again receded, as though Doro, whatever he was enough. When Doro had sent Anyanwu to look after her grandson, he turned to find his own son watching her go, watching the sway of her hips, I just told her how easy she was to read, Doro said. The boy glanced downward, knowing what was coming. You're fairly easy to read yourself, Doro continued.
I can't help it, Isaac muttered. You ought to put more clothes on her.
I will, eventually. For now, just restrain yourself. She's one of the few people aboard who could probably kill you, just as you're one of the few who could kill her. And I'd rather not lose either of you.
I wouldn't hurt her. I like her.
Obviously.
I mean, I know.
She seems to like you, too. The boy hesitated, stared out at the blue water for a moment, then faced Doro almost defiantly.
Do you mean to keep her for yourself?
Doro smiled inwardly. For a while, he said. This was a favorite son, a rare, rare young one, whose talent and temperament had matured exactly as Doro had intended. Doro had controlled the breeding of Isaac's ancestors for millennia, occasionally producing near successes that could be used in breeding, and dangerous, destructive failures that had to be destroyed. Then, finally, true success. Isaac. A healthy, sane son, no more rebellious than was wise for a son of Doro, but powerful enough to propel a ship safely through a hurricane. Isaac stared off in the direction Anyanwu had gone. He shook his head, slowly. I can't imagine how your ability and hers would combine, Doro said, watching him. Isaac swung around in sudden hope. It seems to me the small, complex thing she does within her body would require some of the same ability you use to move large objects outside your body. Isaac frowned.
How can she tell what she's doing down inside herself?
Apparently, she's also a little like one of my Virginia families. They can tell what's going on in closed places or in places miles from them. I've been planning to get you together with a couple of them.
I can see why. I'd be better myself if I could see that way. Wouldn't have run the Mary Magdalene under those rocks last year.
You did well enough. Kept us afloat until we made port.
If I got a child by Anyanwu, maybe he'd have that other kind of sight. I'd rather have her than your Virginians.
Doro laughed aloud. It pleased him to indulge Isaac, and Isaac knew it. Doro was surprised sometimes at how close he felt to the best of his children, and, damn his curiosity, he did want to know what sort of child Isaac and Anyanwu could produce. You'll have the Virginians, he said. You'll have Anyanwu, too. I'll share her with you. Later.
When?
Isaac did nothing to conceal his eagerness. Later, I said. This is a dangerous time for her. She's leaving behind everything she's ever known, and she has no clear idea what she's exchanging it for. If we force too much on her now, she could kill herself before she's been of any use to us.
Chapter 5 Okoye stayed in Doro's cabin, where Anyanwu could care for him until his sickness abated. Then, Doro sent him below with the rest of the slaves. Once the ship was underway and beyond sight of the African coast, the slaves were permitted to roam where they pleased above or below deck. In fact, since they had little or no work to do, they had more freedom than the crew. Thus, there was no reason for Okoye to find the change restrictive. Doro watched him carefully at first to see that he was intelligent enough, or frightened enough, not to start trouble. But Anyanwu had introduced him to Odinkwo, and the young woman seemed to occupy much of his time from then on. Rebellion seemed not to occur to him at all.
They may not please each other as much as they seem to, Anyanwu told Doro. Who knows what is in their minds?
Doro only smiled. What was in the young people's minds was apparent to everyone. Anyanwu was still bothered by their blood relationship. She was more a captive of her people's beliefs than she realized. She seemed to feel especially guilty about this union, since she could have stopped it so easily. But it was clear, even to her, that Okoye and Udenkwo needed each other now, as she needed Doro. Like her, they were feeling very vulnerable, very much alone. Several days into the voyage, Doro brought Okoye on deck, away from Udenkwo, and told him that the ship's captain had the authority to perform a marriage ceremony.
"The white man? Woodley?"
Okoye asked.
"What has he to do with us?"
"In your new country, if you wish to marry, you must pledge yourselves before a priest or a man of authority like Woodley."
The boy shook his head doubtfully.
"Everything is different here. I do not know. My father had chosen a wife for me, and I was pleased with her. Overtures had already been made to her family."
"You will never see her again."
Doro spoke with utter conviction. He met the boy's angry glare calmly.
"The world is not a gentle place, Okoye."
"Shall I marry because you say so?"
For a moment, Doro said nothing. Let the boy think about his stupid words for a moment. Finally, Doro said,
"When I speak to be obeyed, young one, you will know, and you will obey."
Now it was Okoye who kept silent thoughtfully, and though he tried to conceal it, fearfully.
"Must I marry?"
he said at last.
"No."
"She had a husband."
Doro shrugged.
"What will you do with us in this homeland of yours?"
"Perhaps nothing. I will give you land and seed, and some of my people will help you learn the ways of your new home. You will continue to learn English and perhaps Dutch. You will live. But in exchange for what I give, you will obey me whether I come to you tomorrow or 40 years from now."
"What must I do?"
"I don't know yet. Perhaps I will give you a homeless child to care for, a series of children. Perhaps you will give shelter to adults who need it. Perhaps you will carry messages or deliver goods or hold property for me. Perhaps anything, anything at all."
"Wrong things as well as right?"
"Yes."
"Perhaps I will not obey then. Even a slave must follow his own thoughts sometimes."
"That is your decision," Doro agreed.
"What will you do? Kill me?"
"Yes."
Okoye looked away, rubbed his breast where the branding iron had gouged.
"I will obey,"
he whispered. He was silent for a moment, then spoke again wearily.
"I wish to marry, but must the white man make the ceremony?"
"Shall I do it?"
"Yes."
Okoye seemed relieved. So it was. Doro had no legal authority. He simply ordered John Woodley to take credit for performing the ceremony. It was the ceremony Doro wanted the slaves to accept, not the ship's captain. As they had begun to accept unfamiliar foods and strange companions, they must accept new customs. There was no palm wine, as Okoye's family would have provided, had Okoye taken a wife at home in his village, but Doro offered rum, and there were the familiar yams and other foods, less familiar. There was a small feast. There were no relatives except Doro and Anyanwu, but by now the slaves and some members of the crew were familiar and welcome as guests. Doro told them in their own languages what was happening, and they gathered around with laughter and gestures and comments in their own languages and in fragmentary English. Sometimes their meaning was unmistakably clear, and Okoye and Udenkwo were caught between embarrassment and laughter. In the benign atmosphere of the ship, all the slaves were recovering from their invariably harsh homeland experiences. Some of them had been kidnapped from their villages. Some had been sold for witchcraft or for other crimes of which they were usually not guilty. Some had been born slaves, Some had been enslaved during war. All had been treated harshly at some time during their captivity. All had lived through pain, more pain than they cared to remember. All had left kinsmen behind, husbands, wives, parents, children. People they realized by now that they would not see again. But there was kindness on the ship. There was enough food, too much, since the slaves were so few. There were no chains. There were blankets to warm them and the sea air on deck to cool them. There were no whips, no guns. No woman was raped. People wanted to go home, but, like Okoye, they feared Doro too much to complain or revolt. Most of them could not have said why they feared him, but he was the one man they all knew, the one who could speak, at least in limited fashion, with all of them. And once he'd spoken with them, they shied away from attacking him, from doing anything that might bring his anger down on them.
"What have you done to them to make them so afraid?"
Anyanwu asked him on the night of the wedding. "Nothing," Doro said honestly.
"You have seen me with them. I've harmed no one."
He could see that she was not satisfied with this, but that did not matter.
"You do not know what this ship could be," he told her.
And he began to describe to her a slave ship, people packed together so that they could hardly move, and chained in place so that they had to lie in their own filth, beatings, the women routinely raped, torture. Large numbers of slaves, dying, all suffering.
"Waste," Doro finished with disgust. "But those ships carry slaves for sale. My people are only for my own use."
Anyanwu stared at him in silence for a moment.
"Shall I be glad that your slaves will not be wasted?" she asked. "Or shall I fear the uses you will find for them?"
He laughed at her seriousness and gave her a little brandy to drink in celebration of her grandchildren's wedding. He would put her off as long as he could. She did not want answers to her questions. She could have answered them herself. Why did she fear him? To what use did she expect to be put? She understood. She was simply sparing herself. He would spare her too. She was his most valuable cargo, and he was inclined to treat her gently. Okoye and Udenkwo had been married for only 2 days when the great storm hit. Anyanwu, sleeping beside Doro in his too soft bed, was awakened by the drumming of rain and running feet above. The ship lurched and rolled sickeningly, and Anyanwu resigned herself to enduring another storm. Her first storm at sea had been brief and violent and terrifying, but at least experiencing it gave her some idea what to expect now. The crew would be on deck, shouting, struggling with the sails, rushing about in controlled confusion. The slaves would be sick and frightened in their quarters, and Doro would gather with Isaac and a few other members of the crew whose duties seemed to involve nothing more than standing together, watching the trouble, and waiting for it to end.
"What do you do when you gather with them?"
she had asked him once, thinking that perhaps even he had gods he turned to in times of danger.
"Nothing," he told her.
"Then why do you gather?"
"We might be needed," he answered. "The men I gather with are my sons. They have special abilities that could be useful."
He would tell her nothing more, would not speak of these newly acknowledged sons except in warning.
"Leave them alone," he said. "Isaac is the best of them, safe and stable. The others are not safe, not even for you."
Now he went up to his sons again, throwing on the white man's clothing he had taken to wearing as he ran. Anyanwu followed him, depending on her strength and agility to keep her safe. On deck, she found wind and rain more violent than she had imagined. There were blue-white flares of lightning followed by absolute blackness. Great waves swept the deck and would surely have washed her overboard, but for her speed and strength. She held on, adjusting her eyes as quickly as she could. There was always a little light, even when ordinary vision perceived nothing. Finally, she could see, and she could hear above the wind and rain and waves. Fragments of desperate English reached her, and she longed to understand. But if the words were meaningless, there was no mistaking the tone. These people thought they might die soon. Someone slammed into her, knocking her down, then fell on her. She could see that it was only a crewman, battered by wind and waves. Most men had lashed themselves securely to whatever well-anchored objects they could find, and now strove only to endure. The wind picked up suddenly, and with it came a great mountain of water, a wave that rolled the ship over almost onto its side. Anyanwu caught the crewman's arm and, with her other hand, held onto the rail. If she had not, both she and the man would have been swept overboard. She dragged the man closer to her so that she could get an arm around him. Then, for several seconds, she simply held on. Back past the third of the great tree-like masts, on what Isaac had called the poop deck, Doro stood with Isaac and three other men, the sons, waiting to see whether they could be useful. Surely it was time for them to do whatever they could. She could distinguish Isaac easily from the others. He stood apart, his arms raised, his face turned down and to one side to escape some of the wind and rain, his clothing and yellow hair whipping about. For an instant, she thought he looked at her, or in her direction, but he could not have seen her through the darkness and rain. She watched him, fascinated. He had not tied himself to anything, as the others had, yet he stood holding his strange pose while the ship rolled beneath him. The wind blew harder. Waves swept high over the deck, and there were moments when Anyanwu found even her great strength strained, moments when it would have been so easy to let the half-drowned crewman go. But she had not saved the man's life, only to throw it away. She could see that other crewmen were holding on with fingers in line. She saw no one washed overboard. But still, Isaac stood alone, not even holding on with his hands, and utterly indifferent to wind and waves. The ship seemed to be moving faster. Anyanwu felt increased pressure from the wind, felt her body lashed so hard by the rain that she tried to curl away from it against the crewman's body. It seemed that the ship was sailing against the wind, moving like a spirit thing, raising waves of its own. Terrified, Anyanwu could only hold on. Then, gradually, the cloud cover broke, and there were stars. There was a full moon reflecting fragmented light off calm waters. The waves had become gentle and lapped harmlessly at the ship, and the wind became no more than a cold breeze against Anyanwu's wet, nearly naked body. Anyanwu released the crewman and stood up. Around the ship, people were suddenly shouting, freeing themselves, rushing to Isaac. Anyanwu's crewman picked himself up slowly, looked at Isaac, then at Anyanwu. Dazed, he looked up at the clear sky, the moon. Then with a hoarse cry and no backward glance at Anyanwu, he rushed toward Isaac. Anyanwu watched the cheering for a moment, knew it to be cheering now, then stumbled below and back to her cabin. There, she found water everywhere. It sloshed on the floor and the bed was sodden. She stood in it, staring helplessly until Doro came to her, saw the condition of the cabin, and took her away to another, somewhat drier one. "Were you on deck?" he asked her. She nodded. "Then you saw..." She turned to stare at him, uncomprehending.
"What did I see?"
"The very best of my sons," he said proudly. "Isaac, doing what he was born to do. He brought us through the storm, faster than any ship was ever intended to move."
"How?"
"How?" Doro mocked, laughing. "How do you change your shape, woman? How have you lived for 300 years?
She blinked, went to lie down on the bed. Finally, she looked around at the cabin he had brought her to.
"Whose place is this?"
"The captain's," said Doro. "He'll have to make do with less for a while. You stay here. Rest."
"Are all your sons so powerful?"
He laughed again. "Your mind is leaping around tonight, but that's not surprising, I suppose. My other sons do other things. None of them manage their abilities as well as Isaac, though."
Anyanwu lay down wearily. She was not especially tired. Her body was not tired. The strain she had endured was of a kind that should not have bothered her at all once it was over. It was her spirit that was weary. She needed time to sleep. Then she needed to go and find Isaac and look at him and see what she could see beyond the smiling, yellow-haired young man. She closed her eyes and slept, not knowing whether Doro would lie down beside her or not. It was not until later, when she awoke alone, that she realized he had not. Someone was pounding on her door. She shook off sleep easily and got up to open the door. The moment she did, a very tall, thin crewman thrust a semi-conscious Isaac through it into her arms. She staggered for a moment, more from surprise than from the boy's weight. She had caught him reflexively. Now she felt the cold waxiness of his skin. He did not seem to know her, or even to see her. His eyes were half open and staring. Without her arms around him, he would have fallen. She lifted him as though he was a child, laid him on the bed, and covered him with a blanket. Then she looked up and saw that the thin crewman was still there. He was a green-eyed man with a head that was too long and bones that seemed about to break through his splotchy, unshaven brown skin. He was a white man, but the sun had parched him unevenly and he looked diseased. He was one of the ugliest men Anyanwu had ever seen, and he was one of those who had stood beside Doro during the storm, another son. A much lesser son, if looks mattered. This was one of the sons Doro had ordered her to avoid. Well, she would willingly avoid him if he would only leave. He had brought her Isaac. Now he should go away and let her give the boy what care she could. In the back of her mind, she wondered over and over what could be wrong with a boy who could speed great ships through the water. What had happened? Why had Doro not told her Isaac was sick? Her thought of Doro repeated itself strangely as a kind of echo within her mind. She could see Doro suddenly, or an image of him. She saw him as a white man, yellow-haired like Isaac, and green-eyed like the ugly crewman. She had never seen Doro as white, had never heard him describe one of his white bodies, but she knew absolutely that she was seeing him as he had appeared in one of them. She saw the image giving Isaac to her, placing the half-conscious boy into her arms, then abruptly, wrenchingly, she saw herself engaged in wild, frantic sexual intercourse, first with Isaac, then with this ugly, green-eyed man whose name was Lael. Lael Sachs. How did she know that? What was happening? The green-eyed man laughed, and somehow his grating laughter echoed within her, as had the thought of Doro. Somehow, this man was within her very thoughts. She lunged at him and thrust him back through the door, her push hard enough to move a much heavier man. He flew backward out of control, and she slammed the door shut the instant he was through it. Even so, the terrible link she had with him was not broken. She felt pain as he fell and struck his head, stunning pain that dropped her to her knees, where she crouched dizzily, holding her head. Then the pain was gone. He was gone from her thoughts. But he was coming through the door again, shouting words that she knew were curses. He seized her by the throat, literally lifted her to her feet by her neck. He was no weak man, but his strength was nothing compared to her own. She struck him randomly as she broke away and heard him cry out with pain. She looked at him, and for an instant she saw him clearly, the too long face twisted with pain and anger, its mouth open and gasping, its nose smashed flat and spurting blood. She had hurt him more than she intended, but she did not care. No one had the right to go tampering with the very thoughts in her mind. Then the bloody face was gone. A thing stood before her, a being more terrible than any spirit she could imagine, a great, horned, scaly lizard thing of vaguely human shape, but with a thick, lashing tail and a scaly dog head with huge teeth set in jaws that could surely break a man's arm. In terror, Anyanwu transformed herself. It was painful to change so quickly. It was agonizing. She bore the pain with a whimper that came out as a snarl. She had become a leopard, lithe and strong, fast and razor-clawed. She sprang. The spirit screamed, collapsed, and became a man again. Anyanwu hesitated, stood on his chest staring down at him. He was unconscious. He was a vicious, deadly being. Best to kill him now before he could come to and control her thoughts again. It seemed wrong to kill a helpless man, but if this man came to, he might well kill her. Anyanwu! Doro! She closed her ears to him. With a snarl, she tore out the throat of the being under her feet. In one way, that was a mistake. She tasted blood. The speed of her change had depleted her as nothing else could. She had to feed soon. Now! She slashed her victim's shirt out of the way and tore flesh from his breast. She fed desperately, mindlessly, until something struck her hard across the face. She spat in pain and anger, realized dimly that Doro had kicked her. Her muscles tensed. She could kill him. She could kill anyone who interfered with her now. He stood inches from her, head back, as though offering her his throat. Which was exactly what he was doing, of course. "Come," he challenged. "Kill again. It has been a long time since I was a woman." She turned from him, hunger-driven, and tore more flesh from the body of his son. He lifted her bodily and threw her off the corpse. When she tried to return to it, he kicked her, beat her. "Control yourself," he ordered. "Become a woman." She did not know how she made the change. She did not know what held her from tearing him to pieces. Fear? She would not have thought that even fear could hold her at such a time. Doro had not seen the carnage she wrought on her own people so long ago when they attacked her and forced her to change too quickly. She had almost forgotten that part of the killing herself. The shame. Her people did not eat human flesh, but she had eaten it then. She had terrorized them into forgiving her. They outlived all but the legend of what she had done, or her mother had done, or her grandmother. People died. Their children ceased to be certain of exactly what had happened. The story became interwoven with spirits and gods. But what would she do now? She could not terrorize Doro into forgetting the grisly corpse on the floor. Human again, she lay on the floor, face down and averted from the corpse. She was surprised that Doro did not go on beating her, that he did not kill her. She had no doubt that he could. He lifted her, ignoring the blood that covered much of her body, and placed her on the bed beside Isaac. She lay there, limp, not looking at him. Oh, but the meat was warm inside her. Sustenance. She needed more.
"Why is Isaac here?" asked Doro. There was nothing in his voice, not even anger.
"The other one brought him, Lael Sachs. He said you sent Isaac to me."
She stopped, confused.
"No, he did not say it. He was in my thoughts. He..."
"I know." She turned finally to look at him. He looked tired, haggard. He looked like a man in pain, and she wanted to touch him, comfort him. But her hands were covered with blood.
"What else did he tell you?"
She shook her head back and forth against the bed.
"I do not know. He showed an image of me lying with Isaac, then lying with him. He made me see it, almost made me want it."
She turned away again.
"When I tried to send him away without... harming him, he did another thing. Doro, I must have food.
This last was a cry of pain. He heard. Stay here, he said softly. I'll bring you something. He went away. When he was gone, it seemed that she could smell the meat on the floor. It beckoned to her. She moaned and turned her face down to the mattress. Beside her, Isaac made a small sound and moved closer to her. Surprised, she raised her head to look at him. He was still semi-conscious. His eyes were closed now, but she could see that they moved under the lids. And his lips moved, formed silent words. He almost had a black man's mouth, the lips fuller than those of the other whites she had seen. Stiff yellow hairs grew from his face, showing that he had not shaved for a while. He had a broad, square face, not unattractive to An Yanwu, and the sun had burned him a good, even brown. She wondered what white women thought of him. She wondered how white women looked. "Food, An Yanwu," Doro said softly. She jumped, startled. She was becoming a deaf woman. Doro had never been able to approach her unheard before, but that did not matter. Not now. She seized the bread and meat from his hands. Both were hard and dry, the kind of food the crew ate all the time, but they were no challenge to her teeth and jaws. Doro gave her wine, and she gulped it down. The fresh meat on the floor would have been better, but now that she was in control of herself, nothing would make her touch that again.
"Tell me all that happened,"
said Doro, when she had eaten what he had given her. She told him. She needed sleep now, but not as badly as she had needed food, and he deserved to know why his son had died. She expected some comment or action from him when she finished, but he only shook his head and sighed.
"Sleep now, An Yanwu. I will take Lael away, and Isaac. But sleep. You are almost asleep now, almost talking in your sleep."
He reached over her and lifted Isaac from the bed.
"What happened to him?"
she whispered.
"He overextended himself just as you did. He will heal." "He is cold. So cold."
"You would warm him if I left him here. You would warm him as Lael intended. Even your strength would not be enough to stop him once he began to awaken."
And before her slow, drowsy mind questioned this, Doro and Isaac were gone. She never heard him come back for Lael, never knew whether he returned to sleep beside her that night, never cared. Lael Sachs was dropped into the sea the next day. An Yanwu was present at the small ceremony Captain Woodley made. She had not wanted to be, but Doro commanded it. He told everyone what she had done, then made her appear before them. She thought he did it to shame her, and she was ashamed. But later, he explained.
"It was for your protection," he told her. "Everyone aboard has been warned against molesting you. My sons have been doubly warned. Lael chose to ignore me. I cannot seem to breed stupidity out of some of my people. He thought it would be interesting to watch when Isaac came to, as hungry for a woman as you were for food. He thought perhaps he would have you, too, when Isaac had finished."
"But how could he reach out and change the thoughts in my mind?"
"It was his special ability. I've had men who were better at it. Good enough to control you absolutely, even control your changes. You would be no more than clay for such a man to mold. But Lael was the best of his generation to survive. His kind often don't survive long."
"I can understand that,"
An Yanwu said.
"No, you can't," Doro told her. "But you will."
She turned away. They were on deck, so she stared out at the sea where several large fish were leaping into the air and arcing down again into the water. She had watched such creatures before, watched them longingly. She thought she could do what they did, thought she could become one of them. She could almost feel the sensation of wetness, of strength, of moving through the water as swiftly as a bird through the air. She longed to try, and she feared to try. Now, though,